Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. On this episode, we're going to be discussing the new stealth sequel to Cube, as I like to think of it, Escape Room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's about the long and the short of it. It's like if Cube and Saw had an unremarkable baby.
So, for those of you who've been living under a rock for the past 5 years or so and don't know what an escape room is, here's a very quick primer.
This movie's for you.
Right, because it will explain everything about how escape rooms work. Mm-hmm. But since you haven't seen the movie, or maybe you have and you're just a masochist, basically in an escape room, you pay some company either a little or a lot of money to put you in a room with several of your friends or coworkers or what have you for usually 60 minutes, and you have to search the room for clues that will help you escape from the room.
Yes.
It's become a very popular recreational activity. I can't say it's something I've ever done, but...
No, nor I.
It's getting more and more popular to the point where there's just a profusion of escape rooms, even in the most desolate places, yeah. It seems like.
So perhaps a film like this was inevitable?
Yeah, I would say so. How about you lay down a synopsis for us, Matt?
All right. Movie opens with a bang. We see a guy drop down from the ceiling into a well-furnished kind of den, I guess. It's like looks like the smoking room of a gentleman's club or something.
And yeah, it's like the back room of the Yale Club.
Yeah, right. And then the walls start closing in on him, and he's frantically trying to figure out the room's mechanic. You get the impression that he's the lone survivor of a group. He like comes in already pretty harried and wounded.
Yeah, he's limping.
Yeah, and he's talking aloud to himself as he pieces the clues together and connects the dots. If you're the kind of person like me who tends to be put off by characters thinking out loud constantly, then
unnecessarily
this
narrating
movie is like
their
nails
actions
on a chalkboard. Never more so than in this opening scene.
Yes,
he
that's true.
Appears to fail to grok the puzzle mechanic, and the room smushes him. We cut to 3 days earlier. We're introduced to the three characters, one of whom is Ben, who's the gentleman that we just saw getting got by the collapsing room. The other two are Zoe and Jason. Zoe is a timid post-grad student or college student.
Some sort of student.
Yeah, we see her in a quantum physics lecture hall learning about some principle of quantum physics that basically can be encapsulated in the adage that a watched pot never boils. The idea that you're looking at something tampers with it. Or prevents it from changing.
And the scene ends with a truly execrable exchange between Zoe and her professor, where he...
Who's just way too cool teacher for my liking.
Yeah, he just tries to, like, throw in science vocab to give her life advice.
Uh-huh.
Says like something along the lines of, you might think that reducing the number of variables in your life allows for a more controlled system bullshit.
Okay, Miss Frizzle.
Let's
take it down a notch.
It's the first truly cringeworthy moment of the cinema year.
Yeah, he lays it on pretty thick. And Jason, the third member of our merry band, is some kind of a Wall Street fat cat. Kind of,
he's like an investment advisor.
Some kind of, Gordon Gekko motherfucker. And all three of them receive puzzle boxes, like fucking Hellraiser-style puzzle cubes. and they crack them open. Unfortunately, a bunch of BDSM demons don't come spilling out.
Yeah, no pinhead for these sports fans.
So we meet these three. They follow the instructions they find inside their puzzle boxes, and it leads them to a nondescript building where we are then introduced to three further contestants, Danny, Amanda, and Mike. So already the movie has kind of, by introducing them in tears like this, has kind of told you who you're meant to care about.
Yeah, just a little bit. I didn't necessarily think so at the time, but not to put the cart before the horse, but that definitely telegraphs how the movie shakes out.
Yeah, well, this movie very much puts the cart before the horse by even opening with Ben's death in the first place.
That's fair. We'll touch on that more later. Yeah. But just to give a quick rundown of who these characters are, Danny is this, nerd, first of all, but more specifically, escape room nerd. Apparently he has completed 93 different escape rooms.
He's a pretty holistic nerd, I think. He's introduced playing some kind of mobile game on his phone with the volume cranked all the way up.
Yeah, he talks about video games a lot in general. And Jason dunks on him a lot.
Yeah,
for that.
He gets some sick burns in there. Some real, like, 80s style bullying. Real old hat.
Yeah.
It does everything short of giving him a swirly.
Yeah, so that's Danny. Then Amanda is an Iraq War veteran who we find later has survived an IED detonation under a Humvee. She was the only survivor. That becomes a common theme. And then we have Mike, who's
kind of an affable everyman, salt of the earth kind of guy.
That's pretty
truck
much
driver,
sums
cum
it up.
Coal miner.
He has this sort of pseudo monologue talking about how, well, I gotta suck some money away because, you know, truck drivers are the first people who are gonna get replaced by automated vehicles. So
self-driving cars. Yeah.
Self-driving cars. So I gotta do that. One of the funniest lines of the movie is when Jason's just like, "This way to be a buzzkill, man," and Mike just says, "It's just my life."
Indeed it is, and it's about to get a whole lot worse. So they're in this waiting room, kind of reception area, waiting to be led into the escape room proper, but little do they know, the game has already begun. The game is already afoot. The room starts heating up, all of these red-hot coils kind of emerge from the walls and ceiling and start cooking them.
Yeah, in true Cube or Saw fashion, the trap is tripped by something that the contestants did. More specifically, Zoe sees a copy of Fahrenheit 451 on the shelf in this room. And she's like, oh, well, there's this dial on the door and it looks like temperatures. I'm going to turn it up to 451 and then,
The puzzles off. in this movie run the gamut from painfully easy to like completely fucking inscrutable, which it's with seemingly no in between. At least I thought so, this being one of the easier ones. So they then manage to escape by the skin of their teeth by, what is it, they weight down coasters on the coffee table.
They're not even really coasters. They're just like spots on the table that sink that kind of look like coasters.
Pressure plates. Yes. Yeah. So they then wriggle out through an air duct. We then get the first of several like trauma flashbacks, courtesy of is Amanda her name?
Yeah, veteran? Amanda.
Yeah, Amanda has
an Iraq flashback.
PTSD flashback when she's stuck in the vent. And these flashbacks kind of recur. Turns out that all the characters have trauma in their backgrounds.
Yeah, but Zoe talks her down and they get out of the vent.
Yep, they escape into the second of how many? Four or five.
Yeah. I mean, we'll get through them one at a time.
Yeah,
it's a kind of up north cabin, if you will.
Yeah, it's like a log cabin and like Yukon or something. They got another painfully easy riddle that the answer is Rudolph.
There's a crocheted or like needlepoint framed thing that says you'll go down in history,
and it's got like Christmassy. It's got a Christmas the aesthetic to it, you know.
Yeah, and they start trying like 7-letter presidents' names.
Yeah, and there's just a shitload of antlers mounted on the wall, and you can see the fucking cogs turning inexorably in Ben's head as he individually counts off, like he reads the placard underneath every single pair of antlers. Comet, Dasher, Blitzen, Cupid? What does it mean?
Is this when we get his flashback, or is it later?
Yeah, no, that's then, I think.
Okay, yeah, so we get his flashback where, basically, as far as we can tell, he's driving drunk with a bunch of friends in the car, presumably around Christmas, and the song Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer is playing, and they're all singing off key and whatnot shortly before they turn into the path of a semi, I guess.
Yeah.
So he's like, it's Rudolph. And lo and behold, that gets them out into...
out of the frying pan and into the fire, as it were. They escape the cabin and emerge into what appears to be a snowy wilderness. There is a straight-up force field, like a cabin-in-the-woods-style force field, ringing the kind of perimeter of this area. And they're standing kind of on a frozen lake. There's snow falling. There's an abandoned sled, a couple other disparate, thematically relevant elements.
Yeah, they stumble across a hole in the ice, which they inexplicably don't see before they see it. They're out there for 5 or 10 minutes, and they finally...
It's a perfectly circular fishing hole. I think one of them steps right into it. I think it was Ben steps directly into it. And then they have to find a fishing rod. And a lot of the plot synopsis is going to sound like the walkthrough for, like, Myst or something like that. Yeah, they have to find the fishing rod and then find the magnet and attach the magnet to the hook on the end of the fishing rod and then lower it into the fishing hole. And then they pull up a block of ice.
It's in like bound a, in like a metal
girders.
Girders, yeah. The only reason we want to bring up the fishing rod is because Mike is the one who finds it. And Mike, affable every man, is...
he's just so pleased with himself.
And we're pleased for him because he is the perfect affable every man. Uh-huh. He climbs down from this tree and makes a noise that it reminded at least Matt of the Howard Dean scream.
Yeah,
sort of,
I don't
want to... Yeah! He's very pleased with himself that he both climbed a tree and retrieved this tool.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they are freezing to death, so I guess every little bit counts. They have to thaw this block of ice because they've recovered from the lake bed because it has a key in its epicenter. And it's at this point that we get our first casualty. Danny falls through the ice while trying to recover a lighter that they're going to use to try to thaw the block. And
the ice basically explodes under him. It's very arbitrary.
Yes. He's just swept away by a current and never seen again. Everyone's pretty freaked out because up till this point, Danny, again, escape room expert and demonstrable dweeb virgin, apparently. Those are like his divining characteristics. Has been insisting. It's like, well, we didn't get incinerated. We made it out in the nick of time. You know, just think of the lawsuits, man. You know, they're not actually going to hurt us. So then naturally he's the first one to bite the dust.
Yeah, there's only so long we could have the walking escape room encyclopedia around.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's kind of outlived his usefulness after he explicates how escape rooms work for the sake of those in the audience who have never heard of them but still bought a ticket for this movie for some reason. So he gets, you know, flushed away, basically, and then he takes the lighter with him, and our survivors then have to thaw the ice block with their hands, which takes some doing, and they're all shivering their asses off. They finally extricate the key, and they escape into the third chamber, which is an upside-down pool hall.
Yeah.
The floor starts collapsing beneath them. There's a whole bunch of...
one section at a time,
right,
basically.
There's a lot of puzzling going on in this room that I'm not going to recount. The important thing is that Amanda heroically sacrifices herself and plunges to her death.
Yeah, basically throws them a doorknob. It's very elaborate and really not worth getting into.
Needlessly so. And they're still... well, no, I'll touch on that later. They emerge into a hospital room, really more like 5 or 6 hospital rooms kind of smushed together at weird angles. It's meant to reflect various hospital beds that each of the characters found themselves in at some point in their history. And this is when we get long expository dumps of information where they could go around in a circle, basically, and each recount how they were the lone survivor of some tragic calamity.
Yeah, and for those of them who are already dead,
they have to kind of...
they just
re-engineer.
Well, no, it's not even that. They just, like, they have everybody's medical records so they just sort of read them aloud.
Yeah. So they have to, like, infer from that what Danny's damage was. You know, because, I mean, Amanda was a war vet. That writes itself, but Danny seems pretty innocuous.
Yeah.
So It's four men standing now, and shit kind of hits the fan in this room.
They've got 5 minutes to solve the room before it starts filling with poison gas.
Mm.
There's this thing with an EKG machine where basically they have to get like the right heart rate mm-hmm. registered in order to unlock the door.
Yeah. So at first, fucking Jason is zapping Mike with defibrillators, trying to
get his heart rate really high.
Uh-huh.
And of course,
He flatlines.
And then I was confused by the fact that they didn't. Okay, after that, now that he's flatlined, try the paddles one or two more times to try and bring him back. But
yeah,
no, they just let him
die.
They're
not for people who are conscious. They're for people who are flatlining. But I guess Jason had better shit to do. Jason has pretty much turned heel at this point. He's becoming more and more
ruthless survivor.
Yeah, exactly. Look out for number one.
Yeah, he realizes, oh, well, we don't need really high heart rate. We need really low heart rate. So basically, he puts it on himself because, first of all, you know, clearly he's in the best shape. So he has the lowest resting heart rate. Yeah. Although, frankly, with like 2 minutes left to go to live, I don't think anybody's heart rate is going to be real low.
No.
They start with Ben, who's got a heart rate of like 92. For a guy who's not in super great shape, who's faced with the threat of death, that seems ridiculous.
Yeah, my heart rate might have been higher than that, just with my physique, and then from, you know, watching a stressful movie. Because what compounds the insanity of this sequence is that Zoe is running around smashing cameras.
Yeah.
With like a broom handle or something.
Yeah, because she has the quantum physics insight of the quantum Zeno effect, which I'm not convinced is actually the name of a thing, but
sounds like a boss you'd fight in a Metroid game or something like that.
It sounds really silly. But she repeats the thing from her introductory scene and says, like, a system under observation cannot change.
Yeah, right.
So
we
have to stop being observed so we can change the game and not play by their rules. So she's just smashing cameras. But yeah, Jason does his Zen fucking meditation thing.
And he's huffing a bunch of poison probably didn't hurt either.
Right. Because
the room is now rapidly filling with, you know, some kind of toxic gas.
Yeah. He lowers his heart rate to 50. Which is low enough to trigger the door opening.
Mm-hmm.
And he clamors out, and Ben is trying to get Zoe to come. She's still, like, trying to bash open, like, a wall with a thin metal rod, which mm-hmm. seems ridiculous. And Ben gives up, gets out through the duct. And
door
she,
closes behind them.
Yeah, and she falls to the ground.
Yeah.
But the camera sort of slowly pans over to, like, an oxygen mask within reach, and we don't know immediately why they do, but we find out.
Yes. The penultimate room is tiny. It's got a bunch of it's like a Tim Burton opium den kind of thing. It's like got a bunch of black and white spirals on the walls, and it's a room of optical illusions basically, and Jason and Ben start feuding. As in Cube, Jason, who's an African-American gentleman, turns out to be like a closet psychopath. just like in Cube, you hit the 90, 100-minute mark, and the black guy just turns into like a fucking sociopath.
Yeah, 22 years, and we haven't progressed at all.
I mean, he didn't die first.
That's true, but Danny is like an Indian kid, so...
Right.
You know, the brown kid died first, even mm-hmm. if the black guy didn't.
Easy come, easy go, I guess. The two of them start fighting. They trigger something in the room. They get some kind of weird chemical solution on their hands, and they both start tripping balls.
Yeah, it's like on the handle to a door that they open.
Mm-hmm. So things get real fear and loathing on them.
Yes.
They're all bendy and stretchy and hallucinatory. And they start fighting over a syringe that has antidote. Ben, I think, kills Jason, knocks him unconscious.
Yeah, they're like tussling and shoving, and basically he shoves him real hard, and he, you know, hits like a weird corner on the wall at a bad angle and like breaks his neck and hits his head or something.
Yeah. So Ben cures himself and then hops down into the next room, which is the room from the beginning of the movie. We have now caught up with our in medias res thing. And rather than getting smooshed, he manages to escape.
Through the fireplace?
Yeah, well, because he solved the riddle, I'm pretty sure. I'm not going to get into the specifics, but I think that he got the right combination based on, well, I don't know, based on the fact that he made it out, I guess. I mean, it didn't seem like a fluke. It seemed like the room pretty much spat him out. But
It's around this time. I don't remember where exactly. I think it's while Ben is in the Yale Club room for the second time. It cuts back to the hospital room, and these two people in hazmat suits are like on a radio talking about, like, yeah, we got two bodies in here, you know. Some woman on the other end of the line says, okay, 20 minutes for cleanup. And there's an oxygen mask dangling from the ceiling, which is also confusing because the one we saw earlier was definitely on the floor.
That's true.
But whatever. And one of the guys grabs it and looks at it and is like, what was she trying to go for this for? And Zoe gets up off the ground and says something like, to breathe, motherfucker, and hits him over the head with her metal rod or whatever. Yeah. I guess hits the other guy too, knocks them both down.
Takes their gun. Mind you, this is a character who's introduced to us in a scene where she's too timid to raise her hand during a physics lecture.
Where she also knows everything.
Right.
Just to make that even more absurd.
Which, you know, was all, I don't know. The characters having arcs is all well and good, but I could have done without the action movie banter there, you know?
Just a little bit.
Yeah. Breathe.
Yeah. So she's, after this, is capering through, I don't know, side corridors.
Yeah, the
or,
underbelly,
you know,
of the weird facility.
Yeah.
In which all of this has been transpiring. And Ben, our supposed lone survivor, is being debriefed, I guess, by a character who, a very sinister gentleman who emerges from the shadows, who I can only describe as, like, if David Attenborough was Jigsaw. It's like very posh, and but he does like the Jigsaw monologue that you've heard 100 times about how, you know, oh, everyone's soft these days, and you have to, did you ever think that you were capable of getting through that kind of adversity,
blah, blah,
don't
blah.
You yeah. And he alludes to the fact that there's like a bunch of rich maniacs betting on all of this somewhere, and it's the spectacles for their benefit. So needless to say, Ben is not about to get his $10,000.
Well, yeah, he
which, if I hadn't mentioned, was the supposed winnings that you get if you emerge from the safe room.
Yeah, that was the promised prize. Yeah. No, the line that the guy says immediately prior to attempting to strangle Ben is, at the end of the Kentucky Derby, did you think that the winning horse gets a prize? The first thing I thought was like, well, no, but they like put him out to go fuck a bunch of mares. They don't fucking kill them.
No. Yeah,
unless they like somehow win the Kentucky Derby as they're breaking their legs on
they
the finish line.
They don't send the winner to the horse doctor, so his analogy is a little fucked. But yeah, he tries to garrote. I don't know.
Yeah.
He tries to strangle Ben. Zoe shows up, saves the day. They tussle. They kill him. And they escape. And then, oh God, I don't even want to. Okay.
I can do it if
please.
You.
Please. No, no, no. Go. Yeah. You be my guest.
Okay. So I think it's like a day later. And Zoe and Ben are in the hospital. I mean, Ben's in the bed. Zoe's just sort of sitting there watching him. A cop shows up, like a detective, and asks Zoe to come with him. And they go to the building, which has been basically stripped of all incriminating evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So she's doing the standard, like, well, this is where X and Y was. Yeah. And this was the waiting room. And this was the way out. And the cop literally says to her, have you ever seen things that weren't there? And then apparently, you know, they tested Ben's blood and it had like three drugs in it. So his corroboration is worthless.
Yeah. So all through the movie, we've been seeing this name crop up a bunch of times. Do you remember? Is it Wu Tan Yu?
Yes, it's Dr. Wu Tan Yu. W-O-O-T-A-N-Y-U.
Yeah, first and, name, last name.
Yes.
And Wu-Tang Clan coming at you.
Zoe, over the exit out of the first room, or what was the exit, sees graffitied No Way Out.
Mm-hmm.
And then the movie cuts back to an image of like a magazine label that had Wu-Tang Yu's name on it. And that was enough.
Yeah, that was plenty.
That was, in fact, probably more than enough.
Mm-hmm.
But...
because God forbid you reward a second viewing, you know?
Right. So, the movie is not content to stop there.
No.
It starts literally like making the letters float off the wall and rearrange themselves.
Yeah, it looks exactly like that scene in Chamber of Secrets where the ghost of Tom Riddle like reveals that he's Voldemort. It looks extremely silly. There's nothing else in the movie like it. In this movie, I mean, it looks like it's just straight up Harry Potter. The letters turn into CGI and start floating around in front of her face.
And it also takes a ludicrously long time.
Yes.
It's like a 45-second sequence. And the scene basically ends with the cops saying, like, well, okay, we have to leave. It's time to go.
Yeah, those letters just started floating around. This is above my pay grade.
We've been investigating this building for a whole 5 minutes. We've put in our day's work. Let's get out of here.
Yeah.
So
cut to 6 months later.
Yeah, cut to 6 months later. Zoe and Ben meet up for lunch at this sort of upscale restaurant.
Yeah, Ben has cleaned up his act. Before he was kind of a shaggy-headed burnout, and now he looks like some kind of yuppie, kind of clean-cut kind of guy.
Yeah, and they're both kind of talking about how much better their lives are, or at least Ben is, and Zoe breaks out this, like, scrapbook of newspaper cuttings and whatnot, things that she's found that she thinks are linked to whatever shadowy organization is making these escape rooms.
Yeah, because you know, it's stuff like Amanda dying in a hiking accident or Danny drowning in Lake Michigan and shit like that. Basically,
yeah, Mike bodies, having a heart attack.
The bodies having been deposited and foul play having been ruled out by the puppet masters in charge of this whole thing. And she also casually alludes to the fact that, because all of them were invited to participate in this escape room by people they trusted, relatives or friends, loved ones, mentors. I think in Zoe's case, it was her professor.
Yes.
And she just casually drops the fact that all of them are dead, too. It's like, how many fucking people do you have to off just to get this to work once? You know, it's like, I love a good, dumb conspiracy theory, but they're not all created equal.
Speaking of which, Mike was purportedly invited by his nephew, and the only reason I bring that up is because at a very sort of tense moment midway through the movie, they're talking about they're talking about how deep the conspiracy goes, and he's like, my nephew texted me, have a good time.
Yeah, he says it like he's gonna whoop his nephew's ass when he gets out. It turns out someone beat him to it.
Yeah.
So then there's this really farcical final scene where Zoe says, I did some more puzzle bullshit. And it turns out...
she says exactly
those are
that.
Those exact words. And it turns out that they're operating out of a derelict building in Manhattan or something.
Yeah.
And she says, I've got 2 plane tickets. I'm going. We leave in 2 weeks. You should come with me. She talks Ben into it. I don't know how.
Because he's like... 30 seconds beforehand, he's talking about how, like, it's survivor's guilt, you know, we need to move on in order to live our lives, and he's like, you know what, fine, let's go.
Yeah, the whole ending is really rushed and perplexing. So they resolve to do this, cut to a plane with a burning engine plunging out of the sky.
And I thought that was going to be it. I thought it was just going to be that shot. Yeah, and it's like,
serves him
roll,
right.
Got him.
Yeah, but no, it then cuts to like a panicked stewardess on board the plane trying to solve a fucking riddle to, you know, so you think, oh, it's another escape room? Is this like a new batch of contestants? But no, turns out she's in cahoots with them.
Well, yeah, I kept looking around for Ben and Zoe. It's like, oh, well, they're not here.
Yeah, they're not the plane.
This is weird. Yeah. And yeah, it turns out this is just a fucking simulator.
It's a trial run for when they're going to do this exact thing to Ben and Zoe. And this stewardess is like griping about how she like singed her hand on like a piece of fuselage or something. And a very sinister silhouette comes up on a monitor, like Bond villain style, or like Fu Manchu or something. And, you know, says that they can't wait to play another game or something. Cue roll credits.
Yeah. That's Escape Room. So we're going to go ahead and take our break, and then we'll come back and just sort of unload a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be back in a moment.
Yeah.
Well, that's creepy as hell.
Is it getting hotter?
How do we get out of here?
It's Fahrenheit 451. Got it.
Talk about immersive.
What's wrong with you? That was real.
Hey guys, Jim here during the break to let you in on some ways you can help support our podcast. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on iTunes. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Got an idea for the next movie you'd like us to fix? Feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
They knew everything about us.
This is my hospital bed.
Me too.
They made these rooms for us.
Have you ever seen things that weren't there before?
I am not imagining this.
Surviving is a choice.
Yep.
I want out.
Yep.
You let me out of here. No.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
Why they chose us.
And we're back. So I think the first thing that I should mention, particularly given that we're supposed to be a horror movie podcast, is that upon watching the entirety of Escape Room, we both kind of came to the conclusion that it's not really even a horror movie. And it's, I think that's important to point out because it's more or less marketed as one.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's got some of the ingredients there to be a horror movie, but it doesn't really play out like one. Like, there's tension, but there's never even any fright. And I'm not talking about in the way that I mentioned in the bonus episode that A Quiet Place is not a horror movie, maybe. A Quiet Place is far more of a horror movie, I think, than Escape Room is. There are more horrifying things. In Escape Room, it's really just, it's tense. There's stuff going on. There's the threat of death all around, but it's not the jump scares are the be-all and end-all in a horror movie, but there are none.
Mm-hmm.
There's no really, like, creepy images or figures or, I could go on and on, but again, it's not a horror movie.
Yeah, and it becomes, I think, kind of less and less of one as it goes on. I mean, by the end, it's like a straight up like spy espionage thing, but only for the last 2 minutes,
which right? Is
just awfully weird. But yeah, I mean, it's a PG-13 thriller, basically, with kind of a horror conceit.
Mm-hmm.
The premise is conducive to horror, but the movie doesn't really go for broke, which is fine. I mean, we covered a musical last episode, so.
Sure, but it was a zombie musical.
Yeah, tell me about it. I think the characters in this movie diffuse the tension a lot. Like, even up through the third room, the upside-down pool room with the disappearing floor, they're still making a lot of jokey jokes at each other.
Yes.
They're still cracking wise. And this is after Danny bites the bullet, you know? So I figured, like, okay, fun's over, but no, apparently not. I mean, they're clearly stressed out. It's a nervous laughter, but it still lightens the mood a little bit. And that carries on a lot longer than you would have a right to expect, given the premise and the fact that their lives are on the line. Ben in particular keeps riffing on stuff like way longer than he probably ought to have. So I think that does a lot to sort of rob it of its horror potential.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, it doesn't, beyond the stuff I've already said, it also just doesn't, aesthetically, it doesn't look or feel like a horror movie. The lighting is not right, the color palette, whatever you want to point to, it's just, none of the ingredients really feel like they're there.
Yeah, there's a lot of harsh red light at various points in the oven room particularly, which is kind of a horror thing. But yeah, no, I mean, it's really...
There's not even like scare cords, you know?
Not really, except for when they're in the upside down pool hall and they start getting attacked by dial-up internet. You remember this?
Yes.
There's a phone dangling by its cord from the ceiling. And every time it makes a dial-up internet sound, and that's the signal that a new segment of floor is about to.
Although not always, I feel like there are a couple of times where it does that, and then
nothing happens.
Well, no, it's not that nothing happens. It's that the song that's playing, which is "Downtown" by Petula Clark.
Yeah, "Downtown" that's difficult to take seriously.
Yes, the latest in a long line of movies fruitlessly trying to turn, you know, oldies into that are not remotely creepy into creepy horror tropes.
My favorite is "Tiptoe Through the Tulips" from Insidious. It is like, I'm sorry, Tiny Tim just puts a smile on my face. I can't help it.
Yeah.
He just makes me feel at ease.
But yeah, no, there are a couple times where the dial up attacks them and then "Downtown" just starts over again. It's weird,
but like more distorted, which does not make it scarier, by the way.
But for the most part, it just causes the floor to fall in one piece at a time.
Yeah, the individual rooms are gripping individually, but the whole movie just doesn't really hang together for me. It really is just a succession of thematic murder rooms, and that's kind of it. And
yeah, in that way, it kind of reminds me of Hellfest, where there are different haunts, different sections of the park they ran through. I know this is going back a number of episodes. That was like our third, but the tropes are like all different for different sections of the movie, and that movie also doesn't super hang together.
Yeah, because I think what it has in common with Escape Room is that neither really escalate. Well, each room is just as dangerous as the one preceding it and the one subsequent to it, you know, so there isn't a clear sense of things getting incrementally scarier or more dangerous as they progress deeper, which kind of just, so the movie just kind of plateaus, I think, for me, suspense-wise.
Yeah, if there is any variation at all, it's in the second room. Because, yeah, okay, admittedly, at one point, the ice kind of blows up and Danny gets sucked away.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, it really is just...
slow death by hypothermia.
Yeah, so that's not quite as tense as a room being elevated a bunch of stories up and then parts of the floor falling out underneath.
Yeah, or being immolated in a room-sized furnace.
So, there is one dip, but you're right. In general, the movie kind of plateaus because they're all kind of on the same level.
Yeah, and they spend most of the back half of this movie, the characters, I mean, deliver pretty much all of their dialogue at the top of their lungs. Because they're yelling over dial-up internet noises and loud jukeboxes and grinding machinery. And that just gets kind of deadening after a while. It's hard to maintain that level of excitement for very long. There is a lull when they get to the hospital room and start talking about their backstories, but it doesn't last very long. I know what you mean about it not being a horror movie, just kind of in its DNA, just not, it's just aesthetically speaking. There's one flashback, because again, every character gets a traumatic flashback. Jason, Wall Street, has one about how him and his college roommate took a yacht out on tumultuous waters and a wave flipped them over and they were kind of camped out on the hull freezing to death. And he tells this story about his roommate. His roommate became delirious from hypothermia and swam away in the night. And that's a super spooky idea. Just the idea of being out stranded out in the cold and losing your mind. It's a phobia of mine for sure, but
they don't give it enough time to breathe.
No, and the whole flashback is kind of lit like Sin City. Like, it's not monochrome, but it's like
it's
kind
close.
Of, yeah, it's like this weird grayscale thing. It's a very flashbacky kind of effect. And yeah, they should have. If I know that if you did this with every single flashback, this movie would be 2.5 hours long because there's 6 characters, each of whom is the sole survivor of some tragedy. But I feel like that flashback, especially since they return to it later and it becomes kind of a Rashomon thing, which we didn't touch on. When they're in the LSD freakout room, Ben accuses Jason of murdering his roommate.
Well, yeah, this I figured that was encapsulated by you saying that Jason is revealed to be a closet psychopath.
Yeah.
But more specifically,
we didn't touch on the details. But
more specifically, yeah, Ben draws the conclusion based on not that much evidence.
Just based on Jason being kind of a callous dickhead.
Yeah.
About other characters dropping like flies.
Saying like, nah, your roommate didn't swim away. Yeah. You killed him for the only coat to keep warm.
Yeah, because he's watching the flashback with us, apparently. But yeah, no, because they return to that flashback more than once, I wish that they'd lingered on it a little bit more and really captured the eeriness of that idea. Just like seeing your friend just dive into the dark churning waters and swimming out to the horizon.
Well, yeah,
you're out
in dark stormy waters,
yeah, God knows
in the
where.
Middle of nowhere, just you and one other guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he just, without a word,
slips into the water and he's gone,
hops into the water and starts, yeah, swimming away. That could be terrifying.
Yeah.
And this movie does not even remotely go there.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't want to. It's, you know, its priorities are different. I think that that's, you know, pretty much incontestable. Yeah. There's an element of this movie that I was going to joke when we kicked off this recording that as far as January releases go, this movie isn't that bad. And I was going to mention that we kicked off 2018 by watching Insidious: The Last Key,
which was dreadful.
It was pretty bad. And I was like, yeah, well, this is, you know, nothing amazing, but it's not Insidious: The Last Key. And then I looked it up and they were directed by the same person.
What?
Yeah, Adam Robitel did them both.
He's just
the king of middle of the road January horror movies.
Oh my God. That's incredible.
He also did Taking of Deborah Logan, which we referenced a couple episodes ago,
which is probably the best of the three, I would say.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, that ending also shits the bed.
Well, pretty hard, but I don't know, just with the lead in, I think it's still,
yeah, the premise is strong.
But yeah, I will say in general this movie isn't awful. It's certainly watchable. It keeps your attention more or less. And with the exception of some real execrable character work right at the opening, particularly with cool teacher college professor.
Yeah.
I was generally on board with the movie, kind of rolling with it, right up until Zoe gets up and turns action hero to breathe, motherfucker. 'Cause after that, the movie very rapidly descends into a series of just absurd twists.
Yeah.
From that to her saving Ben, to Ben going from, it's implied, like maybe a high school dropout fucking stocking cans in the back room of a grocery store, to being like some kind of sales rep for a hip vegan, I think, dog food company
or
something.
So, yeah, I was kind of checked out at that point, but I'm pretty sure the phrase vegan dog food did in fact pass his lips.
Right. And then obviously after that, the capper with the fucking crashing plane simulator and
yeah,
all that
and then
shit.
Darth Sidious coming up on the hologram. <It's>
just... I think you mean Supreme Leader Snoke. But yeah, no, it's the last 15 minutes. This is the way I put it to Matt while the credits were rolling. I find it hard to say about a movie with as ridiculous a premise as this, but the movie just somehow turned ludicrous in the last 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's definitely when it 100% lost me.
Yeah, I think the whole ethos of the Saw franchise like never worked for me from day one, and now what have there been, like 8 or 9 of them?
8.
Yeah, it's beyond played out. So when he has like a couple kind of amusing lines, but when the evil game master showed up at the end to wax philosophical about how, people need to watch a game with real stakes, you know, a real blood sport. I was just like,
no, they don't. Yeah. Fuck you.
people still watch the Super Bowl in droves. It's still just as good. So like the Saw angle did not and has never worked for me. I guess I like the ingenuity of the traps in this movie. It beats just a pit of used hypodermic needles. You know, that doesn't take a whole lot of imagination. But yeah, no,
fucking Saw 2. So just a real quick detour. Matt and I, several years ago, I hadn't seen it. I don't know if you had.
No,
We finally watched Saw because, you know, it's purported to be this horror landmark, this modern horror. And obviously it made James Wan's career, and now he's just fucking everywhere. But you know what? Saw is not a good fucking movie. The style of the film is absurd with all that, you know, fast motion bullshit.
Yeah.
And yeah, okay, it's kind of a neat twist at the end.
The Benny Hill shit, you mean? Where characters just start thrashing around at the speed of light.
Right, yeah. And it's just, it's not very good.
No.
And we had heard, wrongly, as it turned out, that, hey, Saw 2's actually pretty good. Like, some people even
Well, the people who say that are the people who think that Jigsaw is a really interesting villain. And
yes.
They're mistaken.
Because
he gets a lot more face time in the sequel.
So, yeah, and Saw 2 is the one where, at one point, there's just this pit of used hypodermic needles, which made me profoundly wince, but not because it's creepy, but just because it's gross. Like, fuck off.
Yeah, Saw 2 is a great movie if you watched the Joker interrogation scene in Dark Knight and thought, you know what this needs is to be feature length and starring Donnie Wahlberg in a leukemia patient. that's my glowing recommendation.
Yeah.
Anyway,
sorry.
It's okay. No, I mean, people should know where we stand on the Saw movies because it informs how we feel about Escape Room.
I think that's fair.
The other big influence, as we mentioned up front, is Cube. I prefer the grim, gritty sci-fi trappings of Cube. It's just a much more dismal movie to look at. All the rooms kind of, they're not done up to look like habitable spaces. It's like they're trapped in the bowels of some inconceivable alien spacecraft. I don't love Cube necessarily. It stumbles into some of the same pitfalls that Escape Room does, but there's something about the nature of the evil in Cube that's just inscrutable that I kind of like. It's like an unknowable menace, whereas the antagonists in Escape Room are just so pulpy.
Yeah, no, in Cube, you literally never get any inkling who or what put these people in this cube.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see any fucking silhouettes.
Yeah.
You know, they could be people, they could be robots, they could be fucking aliens, they could be God. You know, who the fuck knows?
Right.
And yeah, I think that's much better than Darth Blofeld or whatever.
Yeah, then breaking open a folder and saying so-and-so died in a hiking accident and so-and-so drowned in Lake Michigan and they also had to kill all of our loved ones just to make a clean getaway. Surely those dominoes would just keep falling. It's like how invariably there are going to be a bunch of loose ends here. I'm overthinking a stupid movie, but hey, it's what we do.
Yeah, I think the one advantage that Escape Room has over Cube, and it's kind of a narrow one because generally the people in Cube are serviceable enough,
mm-hmm.
but Escape Room does have I think, a higher caliber of actor in it.
It's a pretty fun cast for the most part.
Mike, for example, is Tyler Labine, who, among other things, was in Tucker and Dale versus Evil.
Which I've not seen, to my shame.
But which is a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Amanda is Debran Wall, who I think was on True Blood, but I know her more from Daredevil. Everybody in the cast, more or less, is fairly solid. There's not a lot of overacting or really weird decisions, whereas I remember there's a lot of weird acting decisions in Cube, particularly with aforementioned black guy psychopath who
turns into like a real bug-eyed crazy man.
Like, chews scenery to an extent that is rarely witnessed.
I thought the initial meeting with all of them in the sort of receptionist area was really grating. There's like, Jason has a lot of dumb lines picking on Danny for being a nerd.
Yeah, but that's a script problem.
It is. But the script improves after that. Like, their banter improves after that, I think. That's like a standout bad moment for all involved. Because later on, I was pleasantly surprised by the fact that there wasn't as much bickering as I was expecting. Like, you think in a movie like this, they're going to be biting each other's heads off every scene. But there's actually a degree of cooperation for like a couple rooms. It's not to say that there's no friction between them, but they're a more functional problem-solving unit than I had expected. And I think that that's an asset, and that's something to credit the writers with, I suppose.
Yeah, because that's something that in any movie, really, it doesn't have to be a horror movie or a thriller, but any movie that requires people to cooperate that descends into... It's just so tired.
Yeah, it's really irritating to see characters engaging in senseless, self-defeating backbiting.
Yeah, and it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's the tropiest of tropes.
And that does eventually happen, but basically only when it's
Ben and
turned
Jason
into a Thunderdome thing.
Yeah, no.
Where it's just the two of them, yeah.
Yeah, even through the hospital scene where, admittedly, Zoe's kind of off doing her own thing.
Yeah, and Jason is kind of murdering Mike.
But, like, Mike volunteers, after coaxing. It's okay, fine, hit me. So, yeah, the cooperation pretty much lasts up until it's two men enter, one man leaves.
Yeah.
I think the one concrete, specific piece of advice from, a filmmaking perspective that I can point out, certainly other than everything we've outlined, is why do you open with this scene of Ben in the room? Because this tells you that Ben is going to make it to the end of the movie, and most likely everyone else is not. As it turns out, Zoe does too, and they don't telegraph that, again, fairly goofy fucking twist. But certainly, if nothing else, by the time you get to the Tim Burton LSD fucking room, you know that Jason is not going to be the one that gets out of that room.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be Ben.
Exactly.
And whether that ends with death or just being left behind, you're telegraphing the whole thing.
Yeah, and the opening appears to show him getting mashed into jelly, which is misdirection, but there's also a lot of actual direction baked into that, because, as Jim said, you know that the other characters aren't going to make it, and with the exception of Zoe, that's correct. So you can pretty much set your watch by it from there on in. You don't know the order, but you meet Mike, you meet Danny, you meet Amanda, you meet Jason, and they're all dead men walking, basically.
Yeah, and it's silly too, because I knew that Ben was going to be a character in the whole film, because I had seen the trailer several times and he's in a lot of it. Matt, he told me afterwards, thought that this was just going to be some random guy in like a previous group trying to go through the escape room.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the last guy and he didn't make it.
Right.
And that would have been perfectly fine, because the only purpose that the scene serves at present is to set the stakes really high and grab your attention right at the beginning of the movie. And you can accomplish that goal
with some rando,
with some random guy, without telegraphing your entire plot, yeah, more or less.
The moment he got flattened like a pancake and then it faded to black and a message came up that said 3 days earlier, my heart kind of sank. Like, it had just been 3 days later, that would have been fine. But as soon as I was like, oh no, they're doing an in medias res, I don't want to. Yeah, again, just they played their hand too early on that one. We're in complete agreement.
And again, as we sort of mentioned earlier, they've further telegraphed the order of death, more or less, by introducing their characters in two tiers.
Yes.
Because we meet Danny and Mike and Amanda just in the escape room, mm-hmm, without any introductory sequences. Yeah,
they're not part of the montage of puzzle box fiddling,
yeah,
that the rest of the characters get.
We know they're gonna die before everybody else, and yep, sure enough, they're the first three to die.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just some weird choices, and makes perfect sense now that you've told me that this was the director of Insidious: The Last Key, which is also kind of, well, I mean, again, it's not a very good movie, but also it's just very narratively straightforward and, mm-hmm, telegraphs a lot of shit ahead of time, yeah, and not in a clever way.
No. I would say that despite its charms, watching Escape Room is about as frustrating as solving an escape room with a bunch of strangers would actually be in real life. It's like, who designs an escape room that way? You're supposed to go with your friends. Hopefully you kind of know how each other think and you're in it together. It's not like a fucking corporate trust exercise or something where you have to forge bonds with a bunch of people you've never met. I don't know. They all do a laughably little research on escape rooms before showing up. I know that that $10,000 payout is a big carrot on the end of the stick, but you know, just do some cursory Googling,
people. Yeah, pretty much at the beginning of the movie, pretty much nobody knows how any of the shit works except, mm-hmm, for Danny,
yeah,
which is kind of his purpose as a character.
Yes, and as soon as he's divulged all that information, he is swallowed by a lake. Unceremoniously
sucked under exploding ice.
Yeah,
well, I think that more or less wraps things up.
Yeah, in closing, I'll just say that my favorite iteration of this premise is still Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. I think that's the best. The moment that like Augustus Gloop gets sucked up the chocolate hose and then they all get on the boat to go downriver and there's no vacant seat. This is like an internet conspiracy theory, right? That Wonka knew that the kids were going to get picked off at regular intervals, and that's why the boat doesn't have a seat for Augustus or his parents. You know, that's, and then they go down the nightmare tunnel, which is way scarier than anything in escape room
I was going to say the
or Saw.
Fair. No, the boat scene in Willy Wonka is infinitely more terrifying than Jason's boat flashback.
Yeah, and narratively they're virtually identical. It's about a bunch of characters falling prey to themed rooms with death devices in them. Honestly, the room with the bubbles and the giant spinning razor fan could have easily been a set piece in Escape Room. It would have fit right in.
That it would. Well, this has been another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we will see you next time.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Escape Room Trailer Number 1, 2019, Movie Clips Trailers, uploaded by Movie Clips Trailers. All rights reserved. Our next episode, discussing Glass, the conclusion to M. Night Shyamalan's long gestating trilogy, will be up on Sunday, January 27th. See you then.